It's the Neverwinter Nights Podcast.
The Neverwinter Nights Podcast.
The only podcast for the Neverwinter Nights game series, bringing you news, interviews, reviews, and more for the community, by the community. You can find us online at neverwinternightspodcast.com. And now, on to the show.
Hey, this is Brian, a.k.a. Sir Brian from the Realms of Trinity and the Neverwinter Nights Podcast.
I'm Shane Hensley. I'm usually Peg Shane on every game I play.
Hey, this is Ben, a.k.a. DM Silver Adept of the Neverwinter Nights Podcast.
And you're listening to the 163rd episode of the Neverwinter Nights Podcast, a podcast all about the Neverwinter Nights series of role-playing games. Well, today we are here back for the second appearance at Origins. It's kind of the second appearance, because last year when we were here, we were in the media room. So, it wasn't quite an appearance. It was like a semi-appearance. So, this year we're actually out in Event Hall D, and we got a lot of great stuff that we're doing. We got an awesome interview, a follow-up interview, actually, from last year. We have Shane Hensley, formerly of Cryptic, now of Petroglyph and Pinnacle.
That's right.
And we're going to get started talking interview, and first of all, thanks for coming on the show, Shane.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate that. And, you know, let's say that it was a great interview you provided us last time. A lot of people loved it. What have you been doing with your life since that interview?
Great question. So I was executive producer on Neverwinter with Cryptic, as you know, last year. And for various reasons, I wound up having to move back closer to my family. And I work in Las Vegas these days on a game called End of Nations for Petroglyph and Trion. I still live in Arizona, where I work on my Pinnacle stuff, which is my private company. So there's a few facets to me, which is good or bad, depending on your point of view, I suppose.
That's awesome. So you've been working on the End of Nations stuff, and you have...
Uh-huh.
So what? Let's back up a little bit.
Sure.
Okay. So what is your thoughts on the continuation of the Neverwinter project, and you know what do you think how things
right are going? So here's what I think is great about it, and it was unfortunate I had to leave, but so Atari was our publisher with Neverwinter, and they had a fairly finite budget that they were willing to commit to the project, and I thought what Cryptic was doing with it was fantastic in that budget. I really did, and I would say otherwise if I didn't. I'm a fairly candid individual. But when Perfect World bought into Cryptic, they believed that the potential for this game was 4 or 5x what Atari did, and were willing to back it up by giving them more time, and of course more time means more money, right?
Right, right.
And I still talk to all my friends there, and they're ecstatic about what's going on. They love they did some changes to the combat system, which we had been wanting to do, but we couldn't with the time we had left.
Right.
And that seems to be going over really, really well, not only with the focus tests and the external tests that they bring in, but just with the staff themselves. They liked it before, now they love it, and they play it during their lunch breaks, and they're having a great time. So I think the crew there is incredibly happy. They get to add more content. I don't know exactly how they're putting it all together. I don't know if it's a seamless world or just more episodes or what it is, but it's bigger, and there's more for the rest of us who just want to play it to do. And The custom creation tools that we were working on before, I know they've expanded those by 2 or 3x. So there will be even more customization options for all of us.
And that's
incredible. That's what we all really want, right?
Absolutely.
That's great.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm glad that we're able to get that on paper, so to speak. But yeah, hopefully one day soon we'll be able to actually start, working with the community and start building a new community as we move forward to the next level of the Neverwinter franchise, so to speak. You know, I know technically it's not the Neverwinter Nights franchise because of the different publishers now and whatnot,
right.
But it's the theme of it. It's in the right location. Neverwinter.
So, it's like, for me, it's kind of like playing Dawn of War and Space Marine, or even some of the older 40K games. They all take place in the same universe that you love, and the same themes are still there that attract me and I want to play. So Neverwinter is, and Neverwinter Nights aren't the same game, right? But there's enough synergy between the two that I still get excited about both. I love them. If I had a dream scenario, it would be to make Neverwinter as a party-based game, right, where you could actually run around with NPCs with you.
Yeah.
And I think they're doing some of that with pets and retainers and so on, but I don't know what the current plans are, so I don't want to out of turn. And again, I don't work there anymore, but I think that will capture some of that aspect for everybody.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So talk about a little bit about the End of Nations work you've been
awesome.
Doing.
Awesome. So End of Nations is this incredibly ambitious product. It's an MMORTS, massively multiplayer, online, real-time strategy game. It's a mouthful. And what's really cool about it is, you know, if you've played Star Trek or Command and StarCraft or Command and Conquer, any of those, you know, it's really great. You got 4-on-4. You can get a pretty big game going on. Well,
right.
End of Nations, you get 26-on-26.
Wow.
It's a whole different ballgame, right?
Whoa.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And what's great is almost, we're in a miniatures hall here at Origins where there are massive games of 6 and 7 tables and 20 people playing around and are all trying to coordinate. We're doing the same thing online. And that's really exciting because in this game, you might have an airfield that if Brian goes and takes it, it'll give a bombing run to me that I can use to go capture the dam up here, right? Which will turn on the power generators that open the gate for you to get into another part of the battlefield. So coordinating all that is a real challenge and in a fun way. And the groups that coordinate a little more tend to do a little better. We've got some really great play between specializations too. So it's not a, you don't build factories and so forth within the scenario. You come in with different companies. And they're almost like a collectible card game where I might have an anti-air company that I want to go in and play with. And then I run into a guy who's got an all-armor force and I'm not a good match for it. I can actually exfiltrate this company and bring in my anti-armor company at a cost and at the right place. So we have to capture those points to let me do that.
Right.
So you get a lot of really good tactical back and forth, which allows for a big emphasis on RPS, if you're familiar with that term. It's rock, paper, scissors.
Right.
In an RTS, that's a big deal, right? Anti-armor is good against armor. Anti-air is good against air. Air is good against armor, that kind of thing. A lot of fun. Just a blast.
It sounds like it. You know, I looked over and it was like, man, I can get into this. This is cool stuff.
It's great. And in July or August, we'll be launching with the PvP content. And then right after that in September, we launch with the PvE content where you fight the computer in groups of four against these huge battlefields. And they're really wide open. You can attack them any way you want. It's a great game. I'm having a blast playing it.
It sounds like it. So, well, that's a good question. So you're here. Now, are you are you running any formal events like here with the games? Or
I'm running events for Pinnacle here, which, of course, is my little company that I've had for since 1994 now. And we're best known for Deadlands, Savage Worlds, Great Rail Wars, Last Crusade, some of the products we've made. Deadlands is far and away our largest product. And Savage Worlds is our rule set that we run lots of different properties off of, like Solomon Kane, Deadlands, Weird Wars, another favorite of mine.
Yep.
And we do something here called Savage Saturday Night. We do it at all conventions now. What happened was, a couple of years ago, we went to the Origins Award. We won a couple of awards. Everybody was really happy. And there was like 30 of us just hanging out in this big room. And we were trying to figure out, well, what could we do with 30 people? You know, it's hard to play a board game or whatever. So we had a bunch of people there who had already been running games at the show, and they said, well, I could go get my game and run it for 5 or 6 of you. And another guy said it. And that particular year, we did something fun. Everybody rolled a die to see what table you went to. So we actually broke up friend groups, which is kind of neat for a change. And everybody was pretty friendly to start with. And that became a tradition. And so now everywhere we go, we have probably, I don't know what it is at Origins, but we'll have like, say, 20 set tables of events that we sell tickets to and make sure people are showing up for it. And then we'll have another 10 or 12 GMs come and just do pickup games and throw their scenery and figures and everything else out on the table and say, hey, everybody who didn't get into one, come and play. And it's just this great community atmosphere and everybody's laughing and trying to outdo each other. There may be some drinks that flow during these events.
I see. The adult beverage.
There
adult
might beverage. Be. But it's a really fun time. And we have a great laid-back crowd that loves to just game and have fun. And I just love it. It's the best thing we've ever done.
It sounds really cool. I know I did some research on it because I was like, because we don't, you know, we're more electronic gaming.
Right, yep.
But we have roots in pen and paper.
Of course.
Okay, and not just Dungeons and Dragons, so obviously the Savage, you know, the world's engine, the tool set, you know, in that respect, but more of a pen and paper tool set.
That's right.
Is awesome, and, you know, I want to say just looking from the outside, because I haven't got to play a lot of the games that you've created, but I've looked at the stuff, and I'm utterly impressed.
Well, thank you.
I mean, it's very good, very well, very original. And really glad that, you know, be able to actually talk to you about it because, you know, we're looking for originality. You know, we look for originality in game concepts, not just, okay, here's the same thing, and we're just adding a few new chapters.
Right.
It's the person who can go around
Boy, we certainly try to do that. I mean, yeah. I love D&D, right? I've played D&D forever. Sure. I played Pathfinder, I played GURPS. I mean, I love lots of games. I still play lots of games. But we, you know, obviously we love our rule set and what we've done with it. And one of the things we really strive to do is add a lot of excitement to it. So for an example in our game, when you roll the highest number on a die that's called an ace, you get to roll it again, it explodes, right? You get to add to it. And one of the things we're kind of proud of, we don't like to talk a whole lot about, but when you're in a big room full of gamers, people playing other systems, a lot of guys are sitting there very serious and they're looking at every little modifier on their page and everything. And the next table over, our guys are going, woo! And screaming. We kind of like to be the annoying guys in the room. So that's good.
That's awesome.
And you're talking about a twist on things. I don't know if I've shared this, but your D&D fans especially will kind of like this. When 3.0 came out, we did some D20 stuff too, and I wanted to do I wanted to learn the system and try to do something with it. And I ran the trilogy of trilogies, which is the Sahagin trilogy, the Alitha trilogy, and the Beholder trilogy. Are you familiar with those at all? Do you remember those?
Oh yeah, definitely.
So now they were written for second edition, I guess, but we played them with 3.0.
2.0, definitely. Yeah.
And at the end of the Beholder adventure, there is basically this hive mind thing that will tell your players how to get to the Beholder homeworld, or I'm sorry, the Alithid homeworld. And stop them. Well, my players went into the room and I said, this hive mind is emanating this energy at you and it makes an attack or something. So they go charging in and they start stabbing it. And it says, wait, I can tell you how to stop the invasion, right? And they're like, nah, we just kill it. So like, oh, crap. No, stop! You know, and it's trying to plead to them and they're just not listening. They just hack the thing to pieces. And they doomed the world. So I sat back and I thought about it for a second. And I said, well, okay, so a couple of weeks later, the sky goes dark and millions of Alithids invade and you're all cast into slavery and darkness. And they're like, oh. And they're like, oh, that's kind of cool. Let's play that. So that became a game we did called Evernight, where you start off as these big, brave heroes. And I mean, even the sewers smell like rose water in this perfect fantasy world, right? And then these alien things invade, and they're kind of a cross between Alithids and aliens. And they enslaved the world, cast it into darkness, and you are now the rebellion trying to fight back against it. And that was so much fun. I mean, it's one of the most fun campaigns I've ever got to run for people. And it came right out of D&D and what, you know, the foundations of others.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, but I know when Ben used to do a lot of our online DMing, RP events, was exactly what happened to him a lot of times. He'd be like, have an NPC that shouldn't be killed, or it's going to be, here comes the PC. There it is.
Yep.
That he had the idea of dying, and they're like, sorry.
I remember one of the events we did was almost identical to what, you know, you need to go into, in our situation, we have the 9 levels of hell. Well, you had to go there and basically make a deal with one of the lead demons there.
Uh-huh.
To basically get him to get his minions to stop attacking. Instead, they all went, let's kill the immortal guy.
Yeah.
So it was sort of the same thing of, well, now that you guys have lost, and, you know, for that one, I sort of did the same thing, was when they all ported back to the hometown, I completely filled it with demons.
Yeah. And, you know, that's what's great about, you know, the different mediums, the electronic medium, the pen and paper medium. You know, you can really seize on what's best about both, right? The electronic medium, I love the effects and the surprise and the eye candy and the coordination of powers and the things you can do together. That's really exciting, a lot of fun. The pen and paper side doesn't have all that flash and glam, but it's completely subjective. You can do whatever the hell you want, and everybody else can adjust to that, and that's really fun. And I love playing in all these different mediums and, you know, really seizing on what's good about it and running. Same with, like, End of Nations. You know, what we really figured out was, you grabbing that airport so that I can do this, that's what was fun about it. So we emphasize more and more of that. And that's just so much fun.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think that, you know, one thing you touched on and what we're talking about too is, I think you could change the medium, you could change the game, but you can't, people's behavior is the same.
Yes.
You know, that it's NPC is dead.
It sure is.
A lot of times. Unless you get that one smart player that goes, I shouldn't kill that. You know what I mean? I should probably leave that
alone.
Well,
and you know what's great is when they try anyway, like when the guy tried to assassinate Lord British in Ultima Online or something, right? And you get those moments we all talk about for 10 years to come. It's kind of like streaking across the Super Bowl or something.
Yeah.
I guess.
Oh, man. But no, I see what you're saying. And I think a big part of the pen and paper stuff that you've done is you're able to realize that. I mean, you're able to realize that, hey, look, we can bring anything we want to bring to these environments and these worlds and to get stuff done.
Yeah. It's, you know, in computer game development, it's this is more of a mantra than anywhere else. It's probably more subconscious than pen and paper, but find the fun. Right, so when you're making a prototype for a game that's going to cost millions of dollars, you got to find that fun quick and make sure that you've got this core little capsule of, you know, throwing these units at these units is fun in and of itself. Having these guys wander through the dungeon and hacking monsters, that's got to be fun. So you find the fun early. If you start building the entire world around it, and all the systems and icons and animations and so forth before you found the fun, that's when you get into trouble with the game. That's when you got to go in and retcon it, and that's incredibly expensive to throw away all that work you've already done.
Yeah.
So, well, that's my mantra.
Well, especially with your, because now are you the owner of Pinnacle?
I am. No.
Okay, so you understand this all full well then. So as you have to go refactor content because of something not working out, that's costing you probably money, right?
Yeah, I mean, anyway, with Pinnacle, it's just more late nights for me, right? I mean, which is money, but in a different sense.
Yeah.
With something like End of Nations, for example, you know, if they'd gone down the wrong path, we would have had to redo it all, and you got to re-engineer everything. You may have to redo art, you may have to redo animations, and that's, you know, it's 100 and some people, so that's incredibly expensive.
Yeah, that's the one thing difference between, you know, user created, like in our case, Neverwinter Nights, Neverwinter Nights 2, mm-hmm. you know, you have people that are donating their time in most cases.
That's right.
And so if you have to refactor something, at worst, it pisses some people off.
Right. Well, that's a cost, right?
It is. Yeah,
it's cost of enthusiasm and time. Yeah.
You're right. Cost of enthusiasm, cost of players, makes you look professional, unprofessional. And that's something that, you know, just to share with you, I've talked to some other people in the actual gaming community that do the modding and different stuff. I just Neverwinter. Mm-hmm. But the one thing, you know, they brought up was the fact that if you're going to do this, you have to do it professionally. We can't. If you do something half-assed, people see half-assed, and then they don't.
That's right.
You know, if they don't even come in.
Well, I think we all believe this, and it's harder to live up to it, of course. But I think we all believe that if something's worth doing, it's worth doing right. Right.
Absolutely.
Now we don't always succeed at that. None of us do, but we certainly should strive for it.
Right.
And I think on the developer side, for something like Neverwinter, what's great about the Cryptic Crew and what they've done right from the beginning is try to make those user-generated content tools, the UGC tools, as easy as possible so that it's easier for you to succeed. There are less barriers to your success, right? The faster you can make content, the more you can polish that content.
Right. Correct. Yeah, as we shared with you before, a lot of our development time is having to do stuff outside the engine, to do stuff that works. Got to find out what's going to work, what's not going to work.
And what's great from the developer side is when they see you doing that, they realize we didn't have that built in for them to do. You know, and then we go do a cost analysis. Can we do it? Usually they can. So it's great.
So I think definitely. I think that's great. So, you know, anything else going on with your company Pinnacle, like any releases?
Yeah, we have something kind of exciting. It may be over by the time this airs. I don't know when that's going to be, but we... obviously, Kickstarter has done really well for a lot of people. We see, you know, raised $3 million for Wasteland and $1 million for Ogre. I think what we don't talk about so much is the money is very nice to be able to afford it to do a project and have some help doing that. But what's great about it, really for us, is we're doing Deadlands Noir, which is the Deadlands universe, which for those who don't know, Deadlands was originally a Western. There's a post-apocalyptic version and a space version, but you know, that implies there is a long timeline of events, right? So Deadlands Noir is an adventure setting that takes place in the 30s in Deadlands for us. And we're really excited about it, but Noir is a niche. Deadlands is a niche. Role-playing is a niche. So we're kind of a niche of a niche of a niche, right? And we weren't sure that our fans were going to be all that excited about it. So what's great about Kickstarter is not only getting a little help with funding and all, but seeing if people are going to be excited. And it turns out they've been incredibly excited. Our Kickstarter's done very well. And now it's not just a money-raising device, it's a marketing device. And I don't even mean that in a dry, boring marketing sense of the word, but all these guys and gals out there who love to play tabletop games especially, they don't have a lot of great places to find them, right? You may not have a good store nearby that carries Savage Worlds or Gumshoe or Atlas Games, or, you know, the non-D&D games.
Right.
So when they see it posted by their friend on Facebook or linked somewhere back to Kickstarter, it's just been this revolution where, I mean, Steve Jackson's Ogre probably would have sold, you know, a third of that out the gate. Now, he's very successful, does great stuff. It would have sold eventually, but now he sells it faster. He can do it better, make it a better game for all of us. Kickstarter is just an amazing thing for our community. And on the electronic side, I was a diehard Wasteland fan when it first came out. I don't know if you guys are old enough to have played Wasteland.
I've seen it, never
fantastic,
played.
Fantastic, yeah. Right? But as they show in their video, getting a publisher to fund it was really tough. Well, now we see that the fans want it. They've got money to make it. We all benefit. That's what's really great about it.
Right. That's awesome.
Yeah.
It is. Well, you know, like I said, anytime you have an update or anything about your work, you want to. I know the podcast is about Neverwinter, but what we've been moving towards, and it's not just the Neverwinter franchise. I mean, we're going to be covering the new Neverwinter if they let us. You know, we're going
to
be.
We might be able to help there.
Yeah, because we, you know, I want to make sure we don't step on anybody's toes, right? But we definitely would like to continue the community progression from Neverwinter 1 to 2. To Cryptic's Neverwinter. I would love to see the
great.
Slide right into there, and, you know, and us be able to help to build the tool, you know, actually give the, you know, why we need these tool sets to be able to make this wow.
Right.
You know, make it work as successful as the predecessors were.
Well, I tell you what has impressed me about you guys in particular is you're enthusiastic, you know what you're talking about, and I'm sure you're going to have lots of criticisms of whatever comes out, right? But what's great about the attitude you guys have is you will give constructive criticism. And that's what developers need, because, you know, you go online and you got a million people yapping at you. As a developer, unfortunately, we tend to hear the four or five guys who say the nastiest things, right? And
right.
We just feel like crap when we read that stuff. And you don't hear the 999,000
Absolutely.
Guys who are just having a good time enjoying it.
Absolutely.
And really what you need right in the middle is the guys like you who you see the criticisms, you're the guys who have hands-on with it more than, you know, most of the developers at Cryptic through the years, you know, time-wise. You'll be able to see these things, you'll point them out in a constructive way, and they will pay attention to that. And that's fantastic.
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, like we were saying, you know, we're not just working on this, but we're also, like, with what we brought these content authors in. You know, we brought this author in, Maxwell. You know, the idea is that we're trying to show that Neverwinter, no matter what facet it is, whether it's going to be Neverwinter 1, 10 years anniversary coming up. Yes, Neverwinter 2, it's been out for 6 years. The new Cryptic one will be out in December, is it roughly the date they're saying? I think it's
that I don't know.
I think it's around almost the end of the year, we'll say. You know, the bottom line is, no matter what property that you develop on or whatever, the idea is, pen and paper is pen and paper, electronics electronic, but I think when you have these totally configurable and programmable systems, you can really run these things electronically to get more people around the world into your game and exposure.
That's right.
So that's why we're trying to get everybody to go.
I think it's great. And Cryptic needs to be supporting you every way they can, and I will certainly email my friends there and call them and harass them to try to get them to do more and more and more for you.
Appreciate it.
You're doing a lot for them.
Absolutely, which we try.
You are.
We're tired. We've been doing this for a long time.
Well, that's great.
But, you know, thanks again for coming on. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience before we hit the
No,
board?
I think that's it. I just really appreciate you giving me a chance to talk again, and I hope it wasn't too off topic for most of your fans, but I think I would enjoy it if I was listening as a gamer, so I hope they do too.
Yep, I think they'll enjoy it very much so.
Great.
Just as much as we have. So.
Awesome.
Well, thanks again for coming on the show.
Thank you, guys.
Well, welcome to the 2012 Origins Game Fair in downtown Columbus, Ohio. We got a special guest today. It's a really good honor, actually, great honor, actually,
Definitely.
To have you on. It's a very accomplished author in a great genre, no less. Maxwell Drake is here, and we're going to have him get started. You know, first of all, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Wonderful to have you. And just to get started, can you want to tell a little bit about yourself, you know, how you got started into writing, just a little background about yourself.
Well, I teach at a lot of high schools, and that's actually a question I get asked probably every time I go to high school is, what inspired you to write? And I always ask the question, how many kids in here are writing? And usually only a few raise their hands. But my answer to that is nothing inspires a writer to write. I wrote my first novel when I was 12. It was an awesome tale that will never get published because it was written by a 12-year-old. But I've always written. I think that that's most writers. Most people don't end up in their 30s or 40s and go, wow, I should be a writer. I've never written a word, but I should probably do it. I don't think that really happens. I think you're the type of person that always has stories running around in your head. You've always got that desire to entertain others. Sort of like when you watch the home movies of Brad Pitt when he was 4 and he's dancing around, you know, entertaining everybody. You're like, he's going to become an actor. I think writers are the same way. I think you just always have that inner desire to want to tell stories or put things on paper or entertain others.
That's awesome. So you've been writing for a while, obviously. You got into this stuff. Have you ever worked at all or played the pen and paper Dungeons & Dragons or to build campaigns and things like that?
I'm a huge geek. I grew up in the 70s, was when I was in junior high and high school, and that was the prime time for Dungeons & Dragons.
Absolutely.
So I played Dungeons & Dragons. I played pretty much everything TSR put out. We played Gamma World, and of course we got into anything and everything, from Vampire the Masquerade to BattleTech to pretty much anything. I got out before the tabletop games came out, and I have such an addictive personality. I've been trying to stay away from the tabletop games because I don't want to spend all of my money on them. But they look really cool, but I've never tabletop gamed. It's pretty much the only thing I've not done.
That's cool. You know, that's what. Well, I already asked this question off camera, but being that we're on camera and doing a podcast, do you own Neverwinter Nights or Neverwinter Nights 2?
I do own Neverwinter Nights 2, actually. It has never been open.
Even better.
I have.
I'm sorry, NWN1 people.
unfortunately, I love gaming and I love video games, but I have no boss, and so. If you get involved in a video game and you've got all these deadlines or fans wanting stuff to get out and you spend 3 weeks playing a video game, people tend to frown on that. And there's no boss nagging at you to get to work so I can just sit in my underwear and just play video games all day. So I actually have not turned on my PS3 since November. I did end up buying Skyrim, played that nonstop for a couple weeks, and then cold turkeyed it and haven't even nothing. But I probably have 30 games that are not even opened. They're just sitting there waiting for me to finally finish all the projects that I've sold, which hopefully will never happen, and then get into them.
Awesome. Well, it's glad to hear. We like to hear that he has Neverwinter Nights too.
Now, I have played a lot of the predecessors, Baldur's Gate, and I don't know if was Champions of Norrath or any of those the same. Okay.
No.
It's still a three-quarter perspective dungeon crawl. I love those games.
Sure.
I actually really hated. There was a time, especially in the late 90s and early 2000s, that there wasn't a lot of dungeon crawl games. And those are really kind of my favorite games to play. I mean, it's just mindless. You just get the weapons and you kill things and equip better weapons and kill more things. And I mean, there's obviously story and adventure and everything, especially now in the stuff. But it's just nice to go on a dungeon crawl.
Yeah, that's awesome. This is the video. You're up.
So for you know, you've mentioned you like to play a lot of various games. Have you had a favorite one so far?
You know, back when MMOs first started coming out, I got really heavy into them. I've done EverQuest and Ultima Online, and I really stuck with Asheron's Call a long time. Dark Age of Camelot a little bit. But unfortunately, again, with what I'm doing as a career, I cannot even look at a demo for an MMO anymore. I just am not allowed. So I haven't played any of the newer stuff in a long time. And I really do miss it. It's really cool to... role-playing is great because you can have your friends over. And I was even role-playing up until about 2 years ago. And then the group disbanded. Most of them were in the Air Force. I live in an Air Force town in Las Vegas. So most of the people ended up getting moved.
Right.
So we ended up not putting together another campaign. But the nice thing about doing MMO is you've got more than just who can show up at the one location play on one given day and juggle family and jobs and everything else. You can just jump on. And if you have a group of 50, 60, 70 friends, if 10 of them are on, then you've got 10 people that you can play. So I do miss the MMO experience.
Right.
I've got some of my friends are heavy into World of Warcraft. I've never played. But
thank God you've never
played. For the same reason you have.
It's all just time.
Kids.
So
it's time without substance, as we like to say. That's what we... So
I knew many a kid that ended up failing out of college due to World of Warcraft, and that was why I went you know, I'm sure it's a great game. I know they have psychologists actively reviewing how gamers react to games to make it more addictive.
Right.
And that's exactly why I never play it.
Right.
But
I'm old. I'm probably older than everyone here. I grew up in the, you know, I played a lot of Doom, a lot of Doom 2. I love first-person shooters.
Yes.
Quake. And I got into some of the newer ones. I think that, I don't know, the newer ones, I guess it's because I'm just getting older. I'm not as skilled in, or the people that are playing it online are just having more time to me to get good at them. So I tend to stay away from them now, but I do love an old FPS.
Yeah. Yeah, I was huge into enemy territory for a long time.
Yep.
But, yeah, and I agree with you, though, for some of the first-person shooters, is they do sort of make it, I don't want to say quirky, but you have to have a certain skill set that, you know, the old run-and-gun didn't really require.
Right. I do try to buy the ones like Modern Warfare and all that that have a story, and I'll play the single-player version of it. I don't spend a lot of time online with it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I don't. Going back to your original question, I don't know if I have a favorite. I enjoy... I mean, I even play sports games, I play racing games, I play science fiction games, fantasy games. I'm a fantasy author. I've always written, and I love the fantasy genre, so that is definitely where my heart is at, and I gravitate to those. But, I mean, one that I just bought, L.A. Noire. I know it's kind of an old game, but I just bought it from, like, Walmart for in the classic games, because I know I'm not going to play it probably this year. But, you know, it looked really cool to me. It looked like a really good story or whatever. I don't know. I haven't played it. But I'm always looking for, you know, that type of thing. Pretty much anything.
Well, you know, just to kind of talk about that, I mean, can you give us a background, just a 1,000-foot summary for, you know, for the short interview, but at least a little bit of background behind your saga? Because I think this is a great opportunity for people that aren't familiar with it to become at least... familiar with it.
Absolutely. Genesis of Oblivion is high fantasy, so it's sword and sorcery.
Nice.
My tagline is stop regurgitating Tolkien. Not that I have anything against Tolkien, I just don't write elves, dwarves, orcs, or magic the way normal magic is done in a lot of things. I try to think outside of the box. I try to come up with my own, you know, creatures and things. But basically, and this isn't the way the story is now, but the original concept that I had was, I always hated one stereotypical thing in fantasy where you have two brothers and one becomes this awesome, massive, kick-butt fighter, wizard, best at everything, and the other becomes the villain because he's jealous. And it always makes this really horrible, two-dimensional, crappy villain.
Right.
So I had this idea before I started writing it. I was like, what if it was sort of a Civil War thing? What if you had two brothers that were both good and both trying to do the right thing and both cared for each other and wanted to see the other succeed, but some reason they're on a completely opposite side of something. Something that's juxtaposition.
Right.
Something that makes it to where if one succeeds the other. Now that was where it started. It hasn't, it's still got that element to it, but it's not as strong as I thought it was going to be. Because by the second book they're together, they've really, because the story kind of has dictated itself to a certain extent. And even though they start off on opposite sides, at the point where they should have made the decision between family or the thing that they're on, they both chose family. It was just the way the characters decided that they would handle it.
Yeah.
So now they're kind of against the grain of the two sides of what's going on. So where I thought the story was going to go and where it actually is going is a little bit different. But it still has that same, I write with a lot of values and a lot of moral issues and a lot of decisions. And one of the lines that my fans quote a lot is, be willing to pay what needs to be paid. That's kind of a main focal point through the series. And then really what it's become about was the whole saga is, it's a war that happened about 4,000 years ago. The magic in this world ebbs and flows in 1,000-year arcs. And so it went away. The immortals that were back then and fighting this stuff kind of had to either die or go off or hide or integrate themselves into society. And now the magic, after 4,000 years, is starting to come back. So that's why these two brothers are being sucked into this, and there's other characters that are being sucked into this, and, you know, the war that was happening is coming. But really what's happened is, you had all this major stuff that happened, and then it turned into legend, which turned into myth, and then it became religion. And so over 4,000 years, it's been warped, and it's been, and you still have some of the immortals that are pushing for things to happen. So some of the myths, I mean, it's a lot of lies, it's a lot of misdirections. I love to take my readers down a path and say, this is the fact, this is the way reality really works. And then go, eh, not really. I lied. So I do love, you know, that. And the first two books are really about that. By the end of the second book, when the brothers have gone on this quest with some others that they really think they're doing the one thing that's going to solve everything, it's actually the one thing that needs to happen to pretty much screw everything up. So they're the ones, they're the catalyst at the end of the second book that's ruined everything for everyone. And now the third book I call my Empire Strikes Back, because it's a very, the bad is really hitting the fan at this point. So things are not going well for the plane that these guys live on.
Very nice.
Out of curiosity, just something you mentioned triggered something. When you start saying the, you know, the way the characters act start changing the storyline, when you write, do you find that that's something that typically happens, is you sort of start with an idea of this is who this person is, and as you progress, because you are not creating the typical two-dimensional, this is a hero, this is a bad guy sort of setup, that they start...
I think every writer is different. Every writer is going to approach things differently. I plot heavily. I actually spend months writing a book without writing a single word. I write every single scene in a plot form. So I'm very, very rigid in how I plot. But then when I actually start writing the book, I don't look at that. I never go back to it again.
Right.
And I literally just let the muse take over. But I know the story so well that when a character, I don't know how much time we have, but I had a character that the scene was, I knew that the guy was going to go in, he was going to sit in this waiting room to go meet this grand council to get his orders.
Right.
And so I knew the scene, I knew it was going to happen. He's in the room for 30 seconds. And so I'm writing it, he's in there, and all of a sudden somebody says, "Oh, Master Rillian, I'm so glad to see you." And he turns around and there's an old guy walking on the stairs and he says, "Ah, Master Lysentok, I was going to come see you after this meeting." And I'm like, "No, you weren't. I don't even know who this Master Lysentok is. What's this crap?" But I just let it go, and now Master Lysentok is a part of the story. He has, you know, things that needed. So,
right.
You can't write a rigid story, or it will feel rigid. It will feel very confined. And you know, it's one of the reasons why I love being a novelist is if you do a movie, you're confined to technology, to time, to budget, to that screen. Video games are the same way. Even though you can make some massive worlds. I remember in Skyrim, I'm running down a road in the middle of the snow-covered area, and I can see the road go on. I can see trees, and all of a sudden, I just hit a wall, and I'm like, "Why can't I go? I see stuff."
Yeah.
But you know, it's just the way it is, and that's the cool thing about being a novelist is I paint on the canvas of everyone else's imagination, which is limitless.
Right.
So, if you write with limiting yourself, I think you limit the story.
Yeah.
So I do let the characters, and you know, I'm one of those authors that will kill characters off, because I will let them go down a path where I'm going, "Dude, don't do that. You're gonna die. Oh, you're dead." I told you, but you didn't listen.
Yeah.
So you know, it's just.
I'm gonna field question number 5 just to keep the time down.
Okay.
So I know you're low on the time pole, but let's go to 5, and then we'll swing back to 3. Okay. All right, this is a good one. So I talked to you off the camera, Bob, as well. It's like, have you ever considered having your novel turn into a fantasy RPG, you know, possibly even using the Neverwinter Nights 1 or 2 game engine to accomplish that?
You know, I've actually had a couple movie studios approach me about this that I've turned down, mostly because they were very small and the money that they were talking about putting in would have made this look horrible. So I stayed away from that. I have had, I had one game manufacturer that ended up doing a different project, and they were sort of serious. Recently, I actually had a group of fans contact me, and they wanted to do just a role-playing D20, and they kind of just were looking for my blessing. I'm like, "You don't really need that. You just do it on your own. It's not like I'm going to bust down your door and do it." But, you know, they wanted to send me stuff. They wanted me to put some input, and as I have time, I definitely, anything I can, you know, interact with the fans, I'm always willing to do. So, I would love to see it. I mean, I have several different projects. I've got graphic novel projects. I've sold a couple musicals now. So pretty much anything that can continue. I see myself as an entertainer, and that's really all I care about doing is entertaining. So in whatever medium that I get into, the only thing I really am timid of is Hollywood, because I'm scared to death of Hollywood. Every other genre loves writers. Video games love writers. Musicals love writers. Publishers love writers. Hollywood doesn't. If you wrote the best movie script ever and sold it, and they said it's the best movie script ever, the first thing they would do is hire a writer and rewrite it. And then they would hire another writer and rewrite that. So Hollywood scares me a little bit, but yeah, I mean, I would definitely be interested in doing some stuff. I've done a ton of world building. It's a very fleshed out environment. The magic is very fleshed out. The, you know, I'm an old role player, so you can't create worlds without, in the back of your mind, thinking, how would this work on a character sheet? Yeah. How would this work in a, you know, as a gaming engine or as a combat engine or whatever? So this is not a role-playing game as of yet, and I didn't create it as that. I created it as a story, but I can definitely see how it could go that way.
Very cool. Yeah, it's you know, something we talked about before. I mean, we've been doing this podcast for a couple of years before the podcast was incepted in 2006. Just so you know, because we don't have a whole lot of background together, but the point is that there is something called the Neverwinter Nights community now. Mm-hmm. So it comprises of literally millions of people over the period of 10 years, and what they've done, a lot of them, a big segment, not a million, but there's a big segment of professional level developers who use the tool set and they create their single player modules, persistent worlds, which are akin to MMOs but much smaller and more personal. And it's not fixed to Forgotten Realms.
Right.
It's not fixed to Forgotten Realms. We have plenty of them. They're Lord of the Rings based. Well, I know, sorry, you know, just stuff.
No, I love Lord of the Rings.
Sit down.
I'm a huge fan.
To Forgotten Realms.
I just don't write it.
But, you know, we have a lot of that are based in other areas, in different fantasy lores. What you've done is totally portable to this, with this engine.
Right.
Customized classes, races, boom, boom, boom. You can do it all.
So spells. If there's anyone out there that wants to do this, let me know.
There's a challenge to the community.
And I know plenty of top-notch module developers in the Neverwinter 1 and 2 community. I'd be happy to, you know, we're going to put this information on the website. And we're going to have it out there and for everybody to see. You know, I really hope that somebody can pick this up, or if you're, you know, available to give some tutelage, you know,
absolutely,
to that. So Ben's got another question, and I've got one to wrap up.
Which one are we on?
Not the one about teaching around the country.
Number three.
Okay. There's the awkward pause, folks. I'm not editing that out.
For the record, this is a professional point of mine on these podcasts. I must insert at least one awkward pause in the conversation.
Yeah.
So.
But you are going to edit me out when I got naked earlier, right?
We can, yeah.
We'll talk about that.
Well, yeah, right. Brian didn't have his shirt on, so we'll have to cut it.
Right fee, of course. Yeah. But
now that's it. I'm sure the viewers will go.
Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned, and you know, when we were doing a little bit of research, we saw that you do a lot of teaching. Is there something that you enjoy doing about that specifically?
I do a lot of teaching now. I actually got contacted. I've been doing teaching for about 3 years on creative writing. I don't teach English. I don't teach for a specific. I don't teach at a college or a school or anything like that. Although I have taught at colleges and at high schools. I do a lot of conventions. I'm teaching 6 classes here at Origins. I think I'm doing 6 classes at Gen Con. I'm doing 8 classes at Comic-Con in San Diego. I teach at a lot of writers' conferences. I am on a 3-year stint with the Clark County. I live in Las Vegas. Clark County Library District there has me on a 3-year stint. At the end of this year, I'm starting to teach for the Air Force, some creative writing classes for them. I've got a creative writing book coming out this year, and I get a lot of benefits out of it. I really, as horrible as it sounds, I wrote the very first class that I did, which I'm doing right now here in just a few minutes, of how to create more realistic fictitious worlds. And I literally, this is going to sound terribly horrible, but I literally created that so I could start getting into conventions free of charge, because this stuff's expensive for us writers, and most of this comes out of our pocket.
Right.
I know that feeling.
But everyone liked it. And so I created more and I created more, and now I do, Writer's Digest just contacted me. I'm gonna start doing some webinars for them, for the class that I do. And I pretty much just teach creative writing. Creative writing is there's a different way to look at the English language when you're looking at it from a creative writing standpoint than English. It's not English. It's English skewed. I pretty much do everything. I teach everything from backstory and character development and world building, but I also teach the actual fundamentals of writing, showing versus telling, what the different POVs are, strengths and weaknesses, why you should do things certain ways. But the other thing about creative writing that I really try to focus on when I'm teaching my classes is there is no right way to do this. That's the beauty of it. You can pretty much break every rule. The problem is if you break a rule that you didn't know was a rule, everyone sees that and it becomes a mistake. Right. But if you know the rule and you go, if I break this rule in this way, this will be cool. It may or may not be cool, but at least you have a better chance of success. And that's what creative writing is. And that's what publishers and agents are looking for. They're looking for, if you're looking to sell a project, they're looking for things that are different. They're looking, at least that's what they say. They always buy what, you know, they always buy the same stuff over and over again. Not really, but they are looking for, you know, the differences. So I try to teach that in the classes, and I try to teach why you should look at writing. And most people don't. Most people think that writing is about the story. They're, oh, I got this great story, let me write it. And that's only half the picture. The other half of the picture is the craft of writing. It's using words as a vehicle to tell a story, but nobody should ever see those words. You should not even realize you're flipping pages. You should just go, wow, this is a really cool movie in my head. Oh crap, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, I gotta get up at 6. Where did the last 4 hours go?
Yep.
And that's because if you don't have the craft of writing and you break a lot of rules, or if you don't put paragraphs together correctly, or if you tell versus show, then at 11:30 they stumble over something and they go, oh, right, I'm reading a book. Oh, it's 11:30. I should probably go to bed. And then they put the book down. So the craft of writing is something that if you want to get into this professionally, you really need. It's not just about telling a story.
Right.
Anyone, stories are a dime a dozen. I know that sounds really harsh, but if you talk to any agent, any publisher, they'll tell you. Stories are a dime a dozen. Anyone can come up with a good story. Right. Not everyone can tell it in a compelling way that makes you lose track of the real world.
Right.
So, and I don't think I'm there yet. I've only been a professional writer for about 5 years now. And I'm still learning. And that's one of the reasons why I do the classes, is because nothing teaches me better and drives my points home better in my mind than when every week I'm up there basically telling other people what, you know, the different forms of it. So I get a lot out of teaching.
Yeah.
So it's just, it is more than just getting into conventions.
Right. Now,
Godzilla!
Well, you know, I think what you're saying, I mean, it holds a lot of truth. I mean, I see the same type of things happening in different industries, not just in the writing industry, you know, electronic games, whether it's that paper, you know, you name it, movies, you know, you see a lot of that happening. You see a lot of rebirths of old stuff, then you see every once in a while there's something squeaked in, like 12 Monkeys or something.
Yeah.
Right? There's a 12 Monkeys in there, every once in a while.
Right.
I think our nerd cred just went up a little.
Look where we're at. Okay.
Touche.
Okay. So, you know, in closing, I want to ask you, is there anything else? I know we didn't have a whole lot of time to cover a lot of stuff, but there's two things I'll say. First of all, we'd love to have you back sometime on our just audio podcast we record over Skype. We'd love to have you.
Absolutely.
Look up one day on there.
Absolutely.
You got my email address. We can tighten up and have a longer interview when you're more available.
Sounds good.
On top of that, is there anything else you'd like to share with the NWN podcast audience? Talk about your book, where to get it, you know, that good stuff.
Books are available everywhere. I've won several awards with this series now. It's running over 4 out of 5 stars on all the fan review sites. I've never gotten a negative critic review. Can't say that about fan review, but I've never gotten a negative critic review. Actually, I have very, very few negative fan reviews, but you know, you can't please everybody. It is available everywhere. It's coming out in multiple languages. As of next year, it'll be out in Japanese and Korean and Mandarin and Italian. It's out in audiobook. It's read by Cameron Byerly, who reads for Terry Brooks and David Eddings and a few other New York Times bestselling fantasy authors. It's out on all ebook platforms, so everything. I could list them all, but it's on all of them. It's in paperback, hardback. There is a collector's edition that's limited to 5,000, but I'm pretty much the only place to get that now because there's not a huge amount of them left. It's not available at Borders anymore.
Because there are no
Borders. There is no Borders.
Well, it's a collector's item, folks. Get them while they're with the
But it is not available at Borders.
No,
but
it's
Barnes
not
and Nobles, I mean, the publishing industry is changing. It's a dynamic shift. I don't want to name drop. I had dinner with someone last night who has way more books than me. And he walks into a Barnes & Nobles, and you know, he's got in the double digits of books. And he's like, yeah, you know, I'll go into Barnes & Nobles. They have one of my books on the shelf. And I'm like, what does that say to me, you know, who's got a couple books? Where am I going to fit in? So it is hard. You know, I'm in about an average of 20% of the Barnes & Nobles physically. But a lot of times you'll have to order at Amazon, obviously. I mean, it's a different dynamic now. They have less space. It used to be you'd walk into Barnes & Nobles and there'd be just tables and tables and tables of new releases. Now there's tables and tables and tables of Nooks and Nook accessories and more Nook accessories.
Yeah.
So everything is changing in the industry. It's a dynamic shift in where we were in an industry 20 years ago and where we are now. So, but it is available. I mean, you pretty much can get my stuff everywhere. If you do order directly from the publisher, though, it's free shipping, and the publisher's warehouse is in the same town I am, so once a week I go down, and if you do want, you can put an autograph instruction on it, and I will autograph the books. That doesn't work for, like, the next author, the next big author they're coming out with is a guy named J.T. Kartke. He lives in Chicago, so he won't be able to do that, but... I'm a local boy to the warehouse, so I will be able to do that.
Very cool.
So it just it is available everywhere.
Awesome. I like I said, thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
We're gonna.
Hey, real quick, tell me about your wristband.
Oh, we have a media producer insert a question.
I actually got this.
I'm a junkie, so I just want to know.
I got this last year at Comic-Con. They were pushing their Magic the Gathering game, the online one. It was a couple years ago. Actually, it wasn't last year. This has been a couple years ago now. I do love Magic the Gathering. I've got probably about 90,000 Magic cards, although I haven't bought a single Magic card since Ice Age, so mine are all Ice Age to really beta. I've got a few alphas, but really betas when I got into it. But I am so anal about backing up everything that I have two portable hard drives hooked to my computer, plus the hard drive that everything is on. Plus, it backs up to 2 online servers, and every time I leave, I take every one of my projects that I'm working on this. Don't mug me if you want to read the third book. It's coming out in 2 months, I swear to God.
Awesome.
But it is on here, because anything I'm working on, I always, I don't know, I
agree.
Have to keep it,
yeah. I agree.
Like, on me.
Yeah,
it's agreed.
I have 6 pen drives in my laptop for the exact same.
Yeah, we have the same thing going on. We back up externally from all our ROT stuff. I mean, you have to.
Right.
You can't lose that work.
Well, I've got a backup plan. I've got a backup plan to keep up with this. So if any of the fans want to mug me for this, I actually carry my cell phone. And since all of the graphic novel projects that I'm doing are with Magic the Gathering artists, and my cover artist is a Magic the Gathering artist, I've got a lot of personal Magic the Gathering artist cell phones. So when the fans attack me like a horde of zombies, I just go, Magic the Gathering personal phone numbers, and I throw the cell phone out there. And then I run. And so they attack that, and I get away with my flash drive.
So top tip to the horde, go for the cell phone.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, I appreciate coming on again.
Yeah.
You know, if you keep in touch with us, we'll be more than happy to have you back on at any time.
Absolutely.
We've had other authors on our show that actually, we had one just a real quick before we close. We had an author who had created a Neverwinter Nights 1 module first.
Oh, wow.
And turned it into a novel and become a bestseller.
That is awesome.
I'll send you that information just maybe
absolutely.
Help you here. Reverse endeavor.
Yes, we will reverse engineer that.
So, just an idea. Just come to my overly thought mind. Sorry.
Absolutely.
So, thanks again for coming
Thank
on.
Thank you very much.
Really
I appreciate
it.
Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're going to do this a little bit different today. You know, we're going to actually talk a little bit about some of the news in Neverwinter Nights 1 and 2, and we're going to get into some general stuff about the Origins Game Fair. We're doing a news segment at the end of our interviews because we had to work around other individual schedules and stuff like that. So we're going to do the news at the end, and we're going to finish off from there. So,
So
first of all, let's start with the Neverwinter Nights 1 news on the IGN Vault. It's been a while since we scoured it. Was able to find some interesting things. One thing that I will start before I get into the Neverwinter 1 news is that there was some concerns that the IGN Vault was going to be going bye-bye, and it caused a lot of people's butts to tighten up a little bit, you know, and understandably so. There's many years of stuff. The crowd's laughing at that one, but there's many years of work out there, and tons of gigabytes and terabytes and jillabytes of code and whatnot could have possibly been lost to the ether. So that is not happening from what I understand. I think everything looks pretty good. It's not going to happen. And that there is also another site that came out since then. It's been picking up a lot of steam, not to infringe on Steam Powered, but it's been picking a lot of steam up, which is called the Neverwinter Nexus. And it's a website that houses It's a website that houses a lot of information on the Neverwinter Nights 1 and 2, including single-player modules, custom content, information on persistent worlds, and all the above. We posted that on the Neverwinter Nights podcast website on our custom content page where we have the two sites, the two sections for Neverwinter 1 and 2. I added to the both of them so that you can go check out the Nexus 2 as well. So if you are a Neverwinter Nights 1 or 2 custom content creator, go ahead and get your stuff over on the Nexus as well so that we have like a mirrored site basically. And maybe eventually, in case if it does go down, who knows. So getting back into the 1 news, we have the custom content challenge for April 2012. It's the Folk Tales and Myths was the theme for the custom content challenge. And just to refresh everybody's memory for those who don't know, the custom content challenge is where there's a group of custom content creators that actually goes out and creates content for the Neverwinter Nights 1 game engine and actually up to a theme. So it's not really a contest. What it is that people get together and they build their content in this theme, and then they just add it to this package, which then gets published to the IGN Vault under this title. So in this, it's April 2012 when it was Folk Tales and Myths. There's some here's the ones that made it in, which was Shemzu Haru Body Parts was the brownie heads. You had Learned Hand at portraits and various folklore portraits. The Amethyst Dragon, one of our favorite content creators from Neverwinter Nights 1, has put some items and scripts in, various legendary items. Rubies, put some creatures in, Pixie Variations in C Sharp. And Cestus Day, he put a new placeable in. What is that?
Baba Yaga's
Hut. You can add that officially to the name that causes us to lose our minds when we have to read.
Which that'll actually be interesting to see a hut with chicken legs, because that's what Baba Yaga's hut is.
A chicken
Russian
hut.
Russian folklore for those wondering.
Interesting. A chickeny hut. Maybe the bull turkey could show up.
Hey, there you go.
All right, so let's talk about, we got the new tile set. We have the tree houses beta. Wasn't quite an alpha, so they baited it. So we have the two forest tile.
Technical difficulties. Keep going.
Two forest tile tree houses, one placeable tree house, and one placeable rope ladder. Due to walk mesh issues, placements of the rope ladder, tile set, rope ladder, tree house is fiddly, but use it with coordinates and a demo guide to help you out. Should work pretty good. It's just similar stuff that we see in Neverwinter Nights 2 a lot of times, with you get some placeables and the walk meshes are a little bit goofy on the Z index and whatnot. So you want to make sure that, you know, that you take a little bit of care when you're building that and make sure your walk meshes are okay, because, you know, at the end of the day, if you're making an area and it's hard to navigate through by your players, it's not going to work out too good, you know, so. And Ben's got Neverwinter Nights 2 news he's going to cover.
Yep, in Neverwinter Nights 2 news, the first thing we have is a Hydra creature model, which was created by Elysium, who is also known as Frank Perez on the system. And it looks fairly impressive. You know, always neat to add a Hydra when you're setting up various missions for your adventurers to try and struggle through. Better eye textures made by Drew Reckner. And it's basically, he didn't like the way eyes worked as shiny discs and some cutscenes and art features, so he actually made them look more realistic. Which, especially for, I know we have several people who do the Machina.
Right.
You know, for things of that nature, if you want cutscenes, or if you just get creeped out whenever your character walks by a fire, which does make things get creative at times in Neverwinter Nights too, this could be a good solution. So I think we're ready for the special guests.
Yes, and also we'll talk about one more thing though first.
We'll talk about
you know, something important actually, something that you've been caring about. We'll give an update to the Realms of Trinity players and the Neverwinter 2 community in general. We have been plodding along with our third big major development effort. We're not calling it our third campaign, but it's going to be big as a campaign. It's called the Cormyrian Expanse. Obviously, it takes place in Forgotten Realms. It's going to be the whole Cormyr region, basically, for all the way from Darrelun all the way up to Luskan, practically. So we have a pretty large swath of ground to cover here. Looking at around maybe 60 to 80 areas before we're all said and done for this campaign expansion. And, you know, and so we have a lot of good stuff there coming down the line. And we want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to take a look at some of the preview areas we put in the game and on our website. We also have a trailer on our YouTube channel. That's BSB5652. Or you can just go right to the realmsoftrinity.com website. And we have a Facebook and YouTube links right there, right on the page in the middle. So you can go right to our social media sites immediately to go ahead and get what you need for that. Yeah. Also, we've been running... some events out there. We've been running some events. We've been running bi-weekly events, as a matter of fact, Ben and myself. Ben started it off with a whole series of his own events, and then I expanded it off and ran a bi-weekly set of events based in Cormier. It's a strictly RP event where a lot of we have been continuing carrying at least a group of 6 to 8 individual players going through, and we're running basically a pen and paper sub-campaign inside the Realms of Trinity, where we're making a lot of good stuff happen. And, you know, at the end of the day, what we're gonna make sure that, you know, we're gonna use this material that we're getting through Players RP, and we're actually building the world code, the module code, or the persistent world code, to encompass the decisions and paths and plots and give the options that the players did when they were actually going through live. This is a model that I'm trying to talk to some other persistent world runners and module creators to do, because as a developer, Ben and myself have done a lot of writing, Ben especially on the Cormierian Expanse. And I can say, and he can say as well, I'm sure you will agree, that you get so much more out of the players getting in there and getting the job done, you know, at the end of the day, whereas you wouldn't necessarily have done that yourself as the writer. You know, you could take stuff to different places that you may not have thought of taking them that may actually be better than something that you did yourself. Right. So as a writer, as a content creator, and as a player, you can't go wrong. Everybody wins. It's a winning situation. And I'm glad that we're actually seeing it pan out in the Realms of Trinity, and I think that's something to look forward to. What do you definitely think?
No, I mean, it's, as you said, Brian, it's definitely something that we're using to our advantage, because it does allow for the players not only to have an impact, but to sort of give us good feedback as well, to say, okay, when we did this event, we loved the way this area looked, but these creatures didn't make sense, or why is this group here, or things of that nature. So it gives us a sign that here we need more backstory, we need less backstory, or just playing something we thought was a good idea that players didn't like, or something they thought was a good idea that we went, hey, we really should put a side quest or an additional area for this sort of thing. So it's definitely something that we're looking forward to, especially to ramp up and release it. So it's going to be an exciting time for Realms of Trinity.
Yeah, it is. So, you know, that's it for that. And, you know, and also, you know, as we start off with Shane's interview, you know, we actually started a podcast off there, and now we're wrapping up with a news segment.
You're thumping.
You know, at the end of the day, you know, we want to talk about being here at Origins. You know, we are very honored and, you know, glad that the Origins Game Fair staff, especially Erica Gifford, was so accommodating with our setup. You know, getting us this table, nice location around the hall. We're going to have other media that we're going to splice into the podcast once it's edited, and to show a little bit more of what's going on. My media producer's getting antsy over here for just watching the podcast, so I have to be careful how long I go this. So at the end of the day, you know, we have a lot of exciting things that we're seeing here. We actually, on a side note, yesterday we were milling about smartly through the Origins Game Fair. And we happened to come across the Dungeons & Dragons room. And we were able to sit in on a major press, you know, thing with one of the actual individuals at Wizards of the Coast was actually working on D&D 5.0. You know, we sat and listened to some of his conference. You know, people were able to ask questions, and they had chairs set up. It's very similar to something that was posted on YouTube that I'd watched a couple of months ago, people talking about the process of making D&D 5.0. And, you know, we were trying to, actually my media producer, Mike, was trying to snag him. He was walking through right past our table. He looked at the Neverwinter Nights 2 thing, and he just bolted because he probably, unless they want to probably distance themselves from the 3.5 and 3.0 rule sets. So, but regardless, well, they're distancing themselves pretty quickly from 4.0, obviously, because it sucks. But at the end of the day, you know, we tried to get him on, but he wasn't allowed to talk due to the restrictions on, you know, media and stuff with Wizards of the Coast. So we're going to try to maybe possibly get him on a Skype call one day, because we're interested, because a lot of what we do at Neverwinter Nights development, 1-2, doesn't matter, you can do a lot of the stuff from the new systems because a lot of it's programmable. And that's right. The whole idea. So right. Maybe a 5.0 is really cool, but it's closer to 3.0 and 3.5. We as a community, with Cadron especially, or somebody, and get a bunch of people together that are good coders for classes and feats and this and that, that can go in and change the system around to make it to the new stuff. And it would be nice to know about how they're planning on doing it ahead of time.
If we can.
Yeah. My guess is probably won't be able to. But regardless, I just wanted to say that while we're here. I wanted to say, while we're here, just to get the job done, and, you know, bit of things. But there's a lot of people here. It's actually probably the most, there's more people here this year than there was last year, I'm going to say. It's much more lively, an event. And, you know, we're actually set up in the area Hall D. There's a lot of gamers here, a lot of tabletop games, a lot of miniatures and whatnot. If you look around, you know, which we'll have on video, there's a lot of people here for that stuff. Not too interested in Neverwinter Nights. Most of them walk past the table and look at us like we're weirdos. And we're at a gaming convention. So, anyhow, I just want to put it out there. It's not a whole lot of interest for Neverwinter Nights here. But, you know, nonetheless, I mean, we did get a couple... We secured a lot of great interviews with people. And, I like to have gotten up to the Dungeons & Dragons event room so that we could actually been able to snag a few of them people. Maybe we'll leave some leaflets up there.
Yeah.
And there's a couple special guests here today. We're going to try to get Will Wheaton just to stop by. We're not going to be doing a full sit-down podcast interview because we don't have the ability to do so. It's going to be a QA session only. We do, as media, as our press, you know, we're able to get in on a special QA session with all the special guests here at the podcast, at the Origins Game Fair. So we'll get there, and we might ask them a few questions. I don't know. I don't think we're going to be able to record it. But Ben has got some pictures already, ad hoc pictures of the special guests. So we'll put those out there as well.
I just want to note that Star Troopers and Obi-Wan Kenobi have just entered the building.
Hello. And apparently
there's Star Troopers and Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yep.
Yep.
Apparently they have found the droids they are looking for.
Yep. You have not found the podcast you're looking for. Actually, they weren't looking for.
Maybe we can grab that guy for an interview.
That's all right.
I'll be back. I have to go inform that somebody here is a rebel spy.
So on that note, on the Imperial shuttle pulling in, we're going to sign off here at the 2012 Origins Game Fair. You know, I want to say for sure, thanks a lot for watching this. We're going to get this posted up soon enough. I know you're not watching it right now, but we're going to be posting some of the stuff tonight, some snippets tonight. So definitely we're going to go do that. So with that, what are we going to say?
Getting game and level up.
I like it.
You can always reach us via our website at neverwinternightspodcast.com or by email at show@neverwinternightspodcast.com. The opinions and viewpoints expressed on the Neverwinter Nights podcast are not necessarily those of its sponsors or those of Obsidian, BioWare, Atari, their partners, or employees.
The Neverwinter Nights podcast is a production of the Realms of Trinity, who are solely responsible for its contents.
The Neverwinter Nights podcast is copyright 2012.